Good morning. My name is JR. I'm the teaching pastor here at Catalyst, and I wanted to tell you a story this morning about how a dinner party saved the life of a white supremacist. So how many of you have ever heard of a man named Derek Black? I'm assuming that that's not a very familiar. That's okay. I'm going to tell you his story this morning. Back in 2008, there was a secret convention of white supremacists from all over the United States who gathered together, and their goal was, they held this conference because they were going to plan and plot to take back America. And the keynote speaker of this conference was a 19-year-old kid named Derek Black. Derek hosted his own radio show on white supremacy. He had just launched a website on white supremacy that was aimed at children. His father ran Stormfront, which is the largest neo-Nazi website in the United States, and his godfather was David Duke, former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, who is one of probably the most infamous white supremacists in our country. So needless to say, Derek Black is probably not the first person you would invite to have over for dinner, right? Which is interesting because, again, as I said, it turns out that it was a dinner party, actually a series of dinner parties, that saved Derek Black out of white supremacy. That's what we're going to talk about today. So I just want to welcome you this morning to Catalyst because we are, for the next hour or so, going to be talking about what it looks like to be challenged and to learn to hear God's voice speaking to us. So especially if you're a guest with us, I just want to say that the only thing we ask of you is that you be open to hear from God, because we believe that God has gathered us all here, God has welcomed us here, and if we will be open, then God will speak to us. So again, welcome this morning. And today we're going to be learning how to hear God's voice. We're going to be learning to cultivate what psychologist Richard Beck calls strange friendships. So we're going to begin this morning by singing together, by worshiping the God who welcomes all of us to friendship, no matter how strange we are. Because let's be honest, some of us in here are pretty strange, right? So would you stand with me as we begin singing together and worshiping this God who welcomes us and calls us friends? We're in a series right now called Empathy for the Devil. We're actually at the end. We only have 2 weeks of this left, so fortunately for you, we saved the best two for last, right? Today we're talking about Judas, and next week we're talking about Satan. Couldn't do an Empathy for the Devil series and not talk about the devil, right? So that's next week. This series, our goal is to look at some of the most infamous, worst villains of Scripture and try to understand them. Why did they do what they did? And our goal is not to apologize for them or to condone what they did. It's just to ask, why did what they did make sense in their own minds? Because when we do that, we begin to see ourselves reflected in them, and we can actually see where we might be participating in sin where we didn't even know it, and we can turn from that, and we can turn to God and find life. So again, today we're talking about Judas, probably one of the, definitely one of the most hated human beings of all time. In Dante's Inferno, when he's getting his tour of the various circles of hell, and he gets to the ninth circle of hell, the lowest circle of hell, he finds Satan there encased in ice with three heads, and in those heads, two of the jaws are holding Brutus and Cassius, who betrayed Julius Caesar, and then in the third head is Judas. Judas, the ultimate betrayer. Judas, the one who gives Jesus over to the authorities to be killed. If you know the story of Judas at all, that's probably what you know about him, right? That he betrays Jesus with a kiss. He sells Jesus out for 30 pieces of silver. But then something strange happens. After Jesus is arrested and after he's tried by Pilate and condemned to death, Judas tries to give the money back and tries to tell everyone that he lied about Jesus and that Jesus should go free. And when that doesn't work, he kills himself. He hangs himself. Which is interesting because I think usually we treat Judas as like a snake, like he's a greedy snake. He was rotten from the beginning, right? He was always going to betray Jesus. Like that was like his plan all along. But the fact that he tries to give the money back and then kills himself when that doesn't work doesn't seem like a person who was planning to sell Jesus out all along. It actually seems more like someone who realizes he's made a mistake. In fact, if you read carefully through Mark's story of Judas, and you kind of put aside all of the assumptions that we bring because, you know, he's history's greatest villain, we get a different picture of Judas. It seems like Judas wanted Jesus to be arrested, but he didn't expect Jesus to get killed. Which is strange for any first century Jewish person, because growing up, Judas would have seen hundreds, if not thousands, of people crucified. That would have been a very normal thing for him to have experienced. He knew that if Rome arrested someone, that was probably going to end badly, because, you know, Rome didn't particularly care to find justice or to see if this person was innocent. It was easier for them just to crucify them and move on. So if Judas is planning to have Jesus arrested, but didn't expect him to get killed, there must have been something else going on. So I want you to look with me in the Gospel of Mark today. If you have a Bible, it's Mark 14. If you grab one of the free Bibles out of the back, you can find this on page 610. And if you don't own a Bible, please, by all means, keep that one. There's also tons of great Bible apps you can get for your phone or your tablet. But as you're turning or clicking over to Mark chapter 14, this is the moment that Mark tells us triggered Judas to go and betray Jesus. And it's something that we often overlook because, again, we just kind of assumed he was always going to do it. We don't assume that there was any kind of motivation or any kind of inciting incident to trigger his betrayal, but Mark tells us it was this moment in Mark 14. So this is the Tuesday of Passover week, Jesus' last week. Jesus knows that it is his last week, but none of his followers do. And that's despite Jesus' best efforts. Throughout the Gospel of Mark, he's been telling them, hey, we're going to go to Jerusalem, and when we get there, I'm going to be arrested and handed over to the authorities, and they're going to crucify me, and then on the third day, I'm going to rise from the dead. But the disciples consistently refused to hear that. It's like if you've ever been in a conversation with someone and they're like, well, I've got some good things and some bad things to tell you. And you only hear the good things, right? Because you just don't want to hear the stuff that you don't want to hear. That's kind of what the disciples did again and again and again in Mark's gospel. They just couldn't wrap their minds around the idea that Jesus was going to get killed in Jerusalem. And that's because of the expectations they had for Jesus. When they figured out Jesus was the Messiah, they put on Jesus all kinds of cultural expectations of what they thought the Messiah was going to be, that he was going to be this conquering king, that he was God's anointed, chosen person to come in and drive out the Romans and free God's people and establish God's eternal kingdom of peace and justice on earth. So their expectations for Jesus was that he was a conqueror. And when Jesus said, hey, so just so you know, when we get there, I'm going to get killed, they were just like, they just couldn't hear it. None of them could. Not just Judas, but none of them could. And that's going to play into what's happening here, because by this point in the Passover week, things have started to get tense. You'll see right at the beginning of Mark, of this little story in Mark, that the chief leaders of Israel are actively trying to figure out a way to kill Jesus. So tensions are high. And this story is set at a dinner thrown by a dinner party that's thrown by a guy named Simon. And all we know about Simon is he's a former leper. So it seems like Jesus probably healed him. Jesus was known for doing that quite a lot. And then this guy, as you would probably do if you were cured of an incurable disease, right, throws a big party in the honor of the person who cured him and then invites a bunch of people. And this story is set at that party. So let's read together beginning of verse 1 of Mark chapter 14. And remember, we're paying attention to the fact that this is the moment that triggers Judas to go and betray Jesus. Mark tells us it was now 2 days before Passover and the festival of the unleavened bread. The leading priests and teachers of the religious law were still looking for an opportunity to capture Jesus secretly and kill him. But not during the Passover celebration, they agreed, because the people might riot. They loved Jesus, right? Meanwhile, Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon, a man who had previously had leprosy. While he was eating, a woman came in with a beautiful alabaster jar of expensive perfume made from the essence of nard. She broke open the jar and poured the perfume over his head. Now, this alabaster jar actually contains a very strong, pungent perfume that was used in burial rites. In those days, they would prepare the body in the home, and the body would just sort of like sit out in the home for several days. No kind of preservatives of any kind, so it would start to rot pretty quickly. It would start to stink. And so in order to counteract that, they would use these very, very strong perfumes to cover up the odor of death, okay? So imagine the fragrances that you associate with death and dying. It might be that like really strong eucalyptus smell that's in a hospital, like if you were ever had to sit by someone that you loved who was dying, and just that kind of hospital smell kind of becomes forever tied in your brain to that, or maybe it was a certain set of flowers at a funeral, but there are these smells that get associated in our minds with death, right? And for all of the folks sitting at this table eating this feast, this nard would have smelled like a funeral, right? It would have reminded them of all of the people that they had lost, all of the funeral processions that they had been a part of, all the homes that they had been in which a body had been laid out. And so you're sitting there at this table with them, right? And you're eating your lamb or, I don't know, pita bread or whatever they're eating, right? You're eating and you're just, it's delicious, and you're having fun, and there's a party, and things are a little bit tense, but you're trying to just focus on having a good time, and then that smell hits you. And you look up, and there is a woman who is treating Jesus like a dead body. She's pouring this burial perfume on him as though he's already dead. People get mad. Of course, you would probably get mad too, right? This is an extremely poor taste. especially given the tensions of the week and given all that's at stake for this conquering king Messiah that's come riding into town with you following behind him. Now she's treating him like he's dead already? Not cool, lady, right? So some of the people at the table were indignant. They said, why waste such an expensive perfume? It could have been sold for a year's wages and the money given to the poor. So they scolded her harshly. But look how Jesus responds. Jesus replies, leave her alone. Why criticize her for doing such a good thing to me? You will always have the poor among you, and you can help them whenever you want to, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could and has anointed my body for burial ahead of time. I tell you the truth, wherever the good news is preached throughout the world, this woman's deeds will be remembered and discussed. Jesus welcomes what she has done. Jesus says, what she is doing is treating me like a dead body is a good thing. She's prepared my body for burial ahead of time. And then, this is what, we never read verse 10, because in our study Bibles, there's a header break, which means that God didn't want us to read on, right? God wants to, but look what it says next. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12 disciples, went to the lead priest to arrange to betray Jesus to them. This is the incident. This is the moment that convinces Judas that he needs to betray Jesus to the authorities, who are, again, trying to kill Jesus, right? Trying to figure out a way. Why? Again, if Judas is just greedy, if he just wants, you know, some money to remodel his kitchen or whatever, it doesn't make a lot of sense that after Jesus is condemned to death that he'd give the money back. That doesn't work. That doesn't make any sense. But I think if we, again, set aside our assumptions that Judas was rotten from the beginning, that he was just bad and that's why he did these things, which is what we've been trying to do throughout this series, right? Assume these people were a lot more like us than we're comfortable admitting. Then a different kind of motivation emerges. What if Judas was just like all the other disciples? What if he thought that Jesus was the Messiah? What if he thought that when Jesus rode into Jerusalem, that he was riding in as a conquering king? What if this was the moment that Judas had been waiting his entire life for? And then we get to this dinner. And this incredibly awkward moment happens where someone anoints Jesus' body as though he's already dead, as though they're saying, this week is not going to end well for you, Jesus. And Jesus says, yeah, no, thanks. How would you feel? How would you react? What if Judas saw himself as the most faithful disciple? What if he believed that Jesus was the Messiah? That if Jesus were to confront the powers, that the heavens would be torn open and the armies of heaven would descend to fight for their Messiah? Because that's what they believed about the Messiah. And then what if he saw this Messiah giving up? From his perspective, losing faith in himself. Saying, you know what, maybe this was just too much. Maybe I'm in over my head. Maybe I'm just going to end up dead. What would you do? Well, some of us, maybe some of us that consider ourselves crafty and wise and smart, might try to force Jesus' hand. Right? We might try to grab the wheel of history and steer it on the course that we know it should go. We might try to put Jesus in a situation where he had no choice but to fight back or get killed. We might betray Jesus to the authorities and then wait. Surely, when they pull out their swords to arrest him, surely now is the moment the heavens will be rent open. Surely now is the moment that Gabriel will descend leading the armies of heaven. Surely now the trumpet will sound and God will be victorious, but nothing happens except that Jesus is arrested and led to a trial. And the heavens remain shut. And then Jesus is handed over to Pilate, and the heavens remain shut. And then Pilate sentences Jesus to death by crucifixion, and the heavens remain shut. And here Judas realizes he's made a terrible mistake. Somewhere along the way, he's gotten it wrong, and it's resulted in the fact that this teacher, this friend, this rabbi is going to be crucified. And so he tries to stop it. He goes and he gives the money back, and he says, no, I've made a mistake. This man is innocent. And they don't listen. They don't care. And then he kills himself. Because he can't live with what he's done. He can't live with this mistake that he's made. He can't live with the fact that he's betrayed God in the name of God and gotten it wrong. Judas's problem was that he believed in God so much that he was committed to the wrong picture of God. He's committed to this triumphalistic, conquering God. So much so that even when God said, hey, I'm going to die, we're going to go here and I'm going to be crucified and killed, Judas couldn't hear it. And this commitment that he had to God, this faithfulness that he had in the wrong God, led him to betray the very person that he thought he was being faithful to. Friends, that's a terrifying thought for me. I look at a white supremacist like Derek Black. The one who, and again, you know this probably, right? The white supremacy in the United States has a strong Christian thread running through it. The Ku Klux Klan claims to be a Christian organization. They all have this like warped version of Christianity that we can probably all look at and say, like, yeah, whatever picture of God you have that got you there is a bad one. That's pretty obvious from our perspective. But I look at someone like Judas, who like hung out with Jesus for years, who could, you know, you've probably been like driving down the road, and like, huh, I had this question I'd love to ask God. Like, people are always like, yeah, when I get to heaven, I'm gonna ask God this. Well, Judas could just like ask him, right? So all the other disciples, too, it's not like Judas was the only one that got Jesus wrong. Peter denied him three times rather than speaking up at his trial. All the other disciples fled and didn't even follow him that far. They all got him wrong. None of them had it in their minds that even though he said, I'm going to be crucified, killed, and raised from the dead on the third day, none of them heard that somehow, even though he said it multiple times. They all were so captivated by this triumphalistic, conquering Messiah that they had no room in their imagination for a God who dies. And they all missed it. And if even they could miss it, then what hope do we have of getting God right? I mean, that's what kind of freaks me out about Judas's story, right? So how do we know whether we're getting God right or not? Well, earlier in Mark's gospel, he gave us an answer. In your discussion guide that's in the mini, that little QR code where you can get the discussion guide, I gave you this whole part of Mark chapter 8 to read. It's a fascinating story. It's actually when they first kind of figure out he's the Messiah, and then the first time that he tells them that he's going to get killed, and then they completely ignore him. So you can go read that on your own. But at the end of that section, the end of that story, Jesus says this. Calling the crowd to join his disciples, Jesus said, if any of you wants to be my follower, you must turn from your selfish ways and take up your cross and follow me. Okay? In Mark's gospel, you don't understand God. You don't understand Jesus until you see him on the cross. Okay? If you only follow Jesus part of the way, if you don't go all the way to the cross, then you miss who he is completely. Because God is most fully revealed when Jesus is crucified. That's our best picture of who God is. And Mark says, if you don't follow him there, if you don't pick up your cross and follow behind him, then you're just going to miss him. You're going to have the wrong image of God, the wrong picture of God. You're going to be worshiping the wrong God if you don't follow him to the cross. That's what it takes to be his follower. That's all through Mark's gospel. Right? And Judas didn't. Judas hanged himself before Jesus was even dead. For me, that's the most tragic part of Judas's story, was that he gave up. Because again, what he did is no worse than what Peter did by denying him, what all the other disciples did by abandoning him. The difference is that they all got to see Jesus after he was raised from the dead. And they got to be restored to faithfulness in him. They got to see the cross, and Judas didn't. And I wonder what a scene between Jesus and Judas would have looked like if Jesus had approached him. And Judas had seen the mistake that he had made. Of course Jesus would have forgiven him. He forgave everyone else. But Mark says, if you don't follow Jesus to the cross, you miss him. You miss him completely. So I want to ask, because I think it's legitimately, most of us in our, to like tomorrow, right, are probably not going to follow God to a literal cross, right? It could happen. Pretty unlikely. So I do want to spend kind of the rest of our time together today asking if what it takes to see God clearly is following Jesus to the cross, then what does that look like for us in our sort of everyday lives? Like how do we pick up our crosses and follow Jesus? And I think at least at least part of it, is that we insist on this vulnerable faith. Like, we reject a triumphalist, conquesting Christianity that insists on always being right and always getting our way. And we open ourselves to risk. We open ourselves to, again, what I called those strange friendships, to borrow a phrase from Richard Beck. We open ourselves to these strange, we put ourselves in positions that are uncomfortable, that are scary, but open up the possibility of growth. And Jesus did this all the time. Throughout Jesus' whole ministry, he was constantly hanging out with people that everyone else said were disreputable and disrespectable. If you read through the Gospels, you'll see plenty of times where Jesus is at a dinner party, and the religious elites are kind of looking down their noses, and they're like, I don't know what's going on there, but I don't like it. He shouldn't be with those people. Right? Over and over and over and over, that happens. This is a pattern, this is a habit that Jesus did. He made it a regular practice to share table with people that ordinarily probably most like respectable religious people wouldn't have been caught dead with. But for Jesus, this was the good news. This was where the magic happened, was around that table with these strange friends. Because there is something about sharing a table with people that you normally wouldn't share a table with that does something to our spirits. Okay? That's what happened with Derek Black. I told you at the beginning that Derek Black, the leading light of the white supremacist movement, was saved by a dinner party. He was actually saved by a series of dinner parties. See, Derek decided he wanted to go to a liberal arts college. He wanted to go somewhere where his beliefs would be challenged because he wanted to see if his white supremacist convictions could hold up to scrutiny. And so he went to college. And he didn't advertise who he was. He didn't post about his radio show on Facebook. He didn't share links to his White Supremacy for Children website. He didn't do any of that. He just kind of listened and got to know people. And then one semester, he decided to study abroad in Germany, because I guess, you know, if you're a white supremacist, where else are you going to study abroad? And while he was gone for that semester, someone at his school found out who he was. They found his website, and they found his radio show, and they figured out who his father and his godfather were. And by the time Derek returned, everyone at the school knew who he really was, that he was a neo-Nazi. They read the things that he had said about people who looked an awful lot like them. And the whole school had no idea how, you know, some people wanted to kick him out, some people were saying, no, we need to give him a chance, whatever. But there was this one kid named Matthew. Matthew was the only Orthodox Jew at that college. And Matthew had this little tradition that he had created. Because he was the only Jewish kid there, he did these things that he called Sabbath dinners, where he would make a meal and he would just invite people over. And they were Christians and atheists and Buddhists and agnostics and, you know, whoever, all different races, all different ethnicities, all different backgrounds. And they'd gotten pretty popular. There's a pretty good little crew that would show up at Matthew's house for Sabbath dinner every Saturday. So Matthew, the Orthodox Jew, invited Derek, the neo-Nazi. Which is weird, right? If you saw an Orthodox Jew and a neo-Nazi eating dinner together, you'd be like, I'm not sure what is happening here, right? It's strange. And frankly, a lot of people thought it was strange because the attendance at the Sabbath dinners kind of dropped a little bit. People thought it was really awkward to have dinner with Derek Black. But Matthew invited him the next week, and the next week, and the next week, and eventually the attendance kind of picked back up. And Derek began to have difficult, deep conversations across a table from people that he had said terrible things about. Not personally, of course, but like, you know, on his websites and all that stuff. And they began to ask him. They would pull a quote from his website, and they would say, Derek, you said this about me and my people. Like, what's up, man? And they would argue. They would bring like research and facts and statistics and all of this. And this went on for 2 years. Derek's last 2 years at college. By the time Derek graduated, he had disowned his membership in the white supremacy movement, distanced himself from his family, and is now working for racial justice and equality. Because of these dinner parties. Not because he was outed, not because he was publicly shamed, none of that. No, but because an Orthodox Jewish kid invited him into his home. Now, of course, I do want us to reflect on how we might be Matthew, right? Who are the people in our lives that we might find strange that we could extend some hospitality to? But I would also like us to consider how we might be Derek, where we might have a completely wrong picture of God that is shaping in us some very toxic beliefs and behaviors. And we have no idea. Maybe because that's how we were raised, or maybe because that's how we believed for a long time, or maybe because that's just how it is, right? And I want to ask if we have the courage that Matthew exhibited to extend hospitality. If we have the courage that Derek exhibited to say yes to that invitation. Richard Beck calls these strange friendships because, again, when you look at them, you say, I don't know how this works. Right? It's not people that you would normally put together. And that is so scary because it's painful, right? It feels like dying a little death to welcome someone that is not like you, someone maybe that you really disagree with. It's scary to be welcomed by someone that is not like you, that you really deeply disagree with. It is like a little death. Because sometimes that means we keep our mouths shut and keep our ears open. Sometimes it means we ask questions instead of making statements. But if we can begin to do that, if we can begin to hear the voice of the stranger who is becoming our friend, then we learn how to listen to people who are different from us. And here's why that matters. I mean, it matters for a lot of reasons. Here's one important reason it matters. We have much more in common with each other than we have in common with God. If you think I'm strange or someone else is strange, God is much stranger than any other person that you know. And if we cannot learn to listen to the voice of strangers, then we can never learn to hear God's voice speaking to us. God will always and only sound like the echo chambers that we live in. And God will never be able to say anything truly challenging or difficult to us. Every time God says, hey, we're going to go to Jerusalem and I'm going to get arrested and handed over to the authorities and crucified and resurrected, we'll be like, what was that, big guy? Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. Just like the disciples. We can never actually have God speak meaningfully into our lives because we haven't learned how to listen to the voice of the stranger. And that's why we need each other. That's why we need the church. And that's why we need to make it a point to cultivate strange friendships in our lives. Because if we cannot learn to hear the voice of each other's voices, then we will not learn to hear the voice of God. And just like Judas, we will be committed to the wrong picture of God, and we may find ourselves doing and saying things that we would have formerly thought were unspeakable in the name of this false God. In order to save us from that, God has given us the gift of one another. I'm strange. I fully embrace and celebrate that. Okay, some of you are pretty strange too. I love you, right? But you know that. And God has brought us all together and given us each other so that we can help each other learn to hear God's voice. By being in friendship with one another, by welcoming one another, by celebrating one another, by listening to one another and learning from each other, we begin to learn how to hear the voice of the stranger calling to us. And we begin to see a God who is bigger than we ever thought possible, because God is always bigger than the boxes that we build for God. So before we go any further this morning, I want to invite you to come to the communion table with me. We're going to enter into a time of reflection and prayer, asking God to move in us. It's important to note that this table invites us to share the meal that Jesus shared with his followers that night before he was killed, that night when Judas betrayed him. And it's important to note that Jesus set a place for Judas at that table and served him this meal. That means that no matter how wrong your picture of God is, God has prepared a place for you at this table. Because it's not that we figure God out and then are worthy to come to the table. It's that when we come to the table, when we follow God to the cross, that's when we figure out who God is. And so you don't have to be a member of Catalyst to receive communion with us today. If you are willing to cultivate some strange friendships with us, and we're very strange, then you are welcome to come to the table this morning. Before we come to the table, I'm going to lead you in a prayer of examine. I'm going to ask you four questions that ask you to reflect and listen for how God might be calling you to respond to this message this morning. Then I'm going to pray for all of us together. And then as you're ready, you're welcome to come forward and receive communion. So you can assume whatever posture of prayer is comfortable for you. If you like the traditional head bowed, eyes closed, that's fine. Whatever's comfortable. But here's the first question I want you to consider prayerfully this morning. When recently have you been a Matthew? When have you chosen to engage people who are different from you in love? Now, when have you been a Derek? When have you refused to engage people that you see as inferior? That could be in any way. That could be because you disagree with them about an issue, because you have some kind of prejudices. It could be because you just personally don't like them. But when have you refused to engage people that you see as inferior? Now think about the week that's ahead of you. Who in the next week will you be tempted to get contempt for? You'll be tempted to look down on and to write off. How can you choose to engage in a strange friendship this week? How can you choose to engage in a strange friendship this week? Let's pray together. God, we come before you this morning as a people that you have gathered to speak life into us. And we confess that too often it is difficult to hear your voice. We have seen this morning in the story of your servant Judas, who betrayed you, and of Derek Black, how easy it is to miss what you call us to miss who you truly are. It's why you tell us again and again and again that we cannot know you until we know you crucified. And so we come to your communion table today to participate in your death and your resurrection, to follow you to the cross. We bring with us all of our mistaken, wrong, sinful images of you. We ask that in these moments that you help us see you more clearly. We ask that these wafers and juice become a spiritual food. We ask for the grace that we need to be your people in the world, to engage in these strange friendships the way Jesus engaged in strange friendships. Because we know that by learning to be with one another, by learning to hear the voice of the stranger, we become more able to hear you speaking to us, to say those hard things to us, those things that we know that we need to transform, that we need to let you heal in us. And so we approach your table this morning as a people hungry and thirsty for your presence in our lives. Open our eyes that we may see you more clearly, and send us out into the world as agents of your strange and beautiful friendship in which we have all found life. We offer these prayers when we approach your table this morning in the name of your son, Jesus. As you're going, next week we're talking about Satan. I promise it's going to be a lot of fun, very challenging. It really will be. I know that's weird to say, but couldn't do empathy for the devil and not talk about the devil. So we're going to do our best there. It's going to be fun. But as you're going today, you know, I just want to reemphasize that our culture doesn't do conversation well. We're a lot better at fighting than we are listening. And there's so much important stuff happening in our world and in our culture right now that we need to be able to listen to each other. And I think that God has given us an opportunity to learn how to do that well together. And so as you go today, I would just challenge you to seek out those strange friendships. Because as you do, as you learn to hear God's voice, we will all together be more and more and more aware of what it means to be God's people as we learn to hear God's voice better and better. So go be strangers, go make friends, and know that God is with you and that God is working with you. Go in the grace and peace of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. We'll see you next week.